Well, today as we come to worship, we've also come to remember. And as the number of older folk who remember what it's like to live through the Second World War continues to decrease, we have more and more younger folk who've never experienced that kind of wartime experience. Then some people, I think, begin to question, is it really relevant to be regularly remembering? But I want to suggest this morning that there are some very good reasons for regularly remembering. In our first Bible reading, we learnt that God actually commanded Joshua and the people of Israel to make sure to regularly remember important points in their history. So, why is it important for us to remember? Well, firstly, because remembering can increase our awareness of God, and it can be encouraging for us today and in the future. And as Christians, we believe in a God who acts in history, a God who not only created us, but who loves us and cares for us, a God who's continually involved in the lives and the affairs of us, his people who he created. And the whole of the Bible, but particularly perhaps the Old Testament, tells the story of God being very much with his people. His chosen people, the Jews, through their history, over thousands of years, God was with them in good times, in problems, in hard times, in suffering, certainly frequently in times of war and destruction, and even, they found, when they were in exile. And it's in those hard times that we read that the Jewish people and their leaders sometimes realized that their relationship with God was just not as it should be. They were not following, they were not obeying properly. And then we see them coming together as a nation even sometimes and asking forgiveness and returning to God. Those times of difficulty and danger, and especially war times, are often the times, I think, when our awareness of God increases and when we want to turn to God. Wars and major disasters are what kind of bring us down to size. They help us realize our need of God. In fact, it's in those difficult times that even atheists pray. One of the most outstanding leaders of the United Church in Papua New Guinea, Bishop Sir Simon Gyas, was a young pastor during the war years in the Rabaul area of Papua New Guinea. And Rabaul at that time was completely destroyed by Japanese bombing, and the Japanese then set up a kind of underground headquarters there for the South Pacific campaign. In that area, there was a very heavy loss of life. Soldiers, civilians, missionaries, local church leaders and pastors all suffered. And at one point, Simon and his wife and their young child found it necessary to flee from the village where Simon was the pastor. The problem was that if he stayed, the villagers might be put in danger by his presence when the Japanese targeted local leaders. And so the family had a long, dangerous trek over three mountains, through several rivers. It took them all one night and all the next day. And all through that time, they simply didn't know whether they were going to make it or whether the Japanese were going to catch up with them. But Simon experienced a very real peace on his way there, and he really felt a presence with them, travelling and guiding them. And that experience, during which he was so aware of God's presence, made a lasting impact on his life as he went on to become one of the churches and one of the nation's longest-serving and most respected leaders. It changed his life. Now, our first Bible reading tells the story of one of the very significant times when God acted in history to save his Jewish people. By the time we come to that story from the book of Joshua, we see that the Israelites had already fled from Egypt, led by Moses. The Red Sea had already been opened for them to cross safely. And now Joshua, Moses' successor, following God's instructions, led the people across the River Jordan. And when they'd crossed safely over that river on dry land, Joshua told them that they should pick up 12 stones, one for each of the tribes of Israel, and they took them to the first place where they made camp at a place called Gilgal and made a pile of the stones there. And then Joshua said to the people of Israel, "In the future, when your children ask you what these stones mean, you'll tell them about the time when Israel crossed the Jordan on dry ground. Tell them that the Lord your God dried up the waters of the River Jordan for you until you had crossed, just as he dried up the Red Sea for us. Because of this, everyone on earth will know how great the Lord's power is, and you will honor the Lord your God forever." And there were Joshua's instructions to the people a little further on than the reading we heard in Joshua chapter 4. And so the Israelites were commanded by God to remember and to pass on the stories of what God had done for them to their children so that the nation would continue to remember. And in the same way, remembering what God has done for us in our lives and experience can encourage us in our own faith. It encourages us, especially, I think, when we remember the experience and the truth which the writer to Hebrews wrote about in chapter 13. The fact that God in Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. It's the same God who helped the people of Israel and who helped Simon Gaius during the Second World War, who helps us today, who's helped us in the past and continues to help us. So remembering can encourage us for today and it can encourage us for our future too. Then secondly, remembering helps us to learn from the example of other people's faith and courage. God can teach us a lot through the lives of others, I think. The writer to the Hebrews, again, encouraged Christians to remember in that kind of way. As some of you will remember well, Hebrews chapter 11 gives a long list of those who lived by faith, right through the history of the Israelites, and then goes on in chapter 13 and verse 7 to encourage us to remember your former leaders who spoke God's message to you. Think back on how they lived and died and imitate their faith. And of course, that's especially meaningful when we put chapter verse 8 after verse 7. Think back on how they lived and died and imitate their faith. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Probably the most significant part of the recent history of the Solomon Islands in the Pacific, as well as many other of the Pacific Island groups, apart from the coming of the gospel, which was something very revolutionary in that area, was the Second World War years. During the war, those quiet, peaceful islands suddenly became a focal point for the Pacific campaign when the Japanese invaded and they pushed southwards through the Pacific towards Australia. But as we know, they didn't actually reach Australia. They didn't actually reach Australia because they were turned back on the island of Guadalcanal. I'm sure some people will remember that name Guadalcanal from war reports. I'm not sure that so many people necessarily know where Guadalcanal is and know that it's in part of the Solomon Islands today. But I think until relatively recently, the largest number of overseas visitors to the Solomons was war veterans from Japan and USA and Australia and New Zealand, who returned regularly to remember what happened during the war. about 14 years ago than now, the Americans built a most impressive new war memorial. It's high up on the coast of Guadalcanal, looking right out over to sea, the area which is called Iron Bottom Sound, because over 50 wrecks of ships sunk in naval battles during the war are still there. And when the Japanese invaded the Solomons, the Australians and Americans organized a network of coast watchers who worked with the Solomon Islands. Those were the people who were largely responsible for making possible the eventual defeat of Japan. And this is how the book Lonely Vigil sums up a bit of their story. That in 1942, Japan held the South Pacific in its grip. But on the Solomon Islands, a handful of men, and to begin with there were some women too, but they were then taken off, a maverick crew of missionaries and gold miners, planters and traders, made their stand behind enemy lines. Against staggering odds, they relayed valuable intelligence. In hundreds of daring operations, they rescued Allied airmen and soldiers from hostile waters. They helped turn the tide of war in the Pacific. And those of you who've seen or remember the musical South Pacific will remember that that's the setting for that musical. That's what was going on in it. The coast watchers, of course, were kept hidden by Solomon Islanders. There was a network of Solomon Island scouts who worked with them. And it was the Solomon Islanders who were the ones who were able to actually move around and carry out operations. And probably the best known rescue operation during that Second World War period in the Solomons was the rescue of a young American patrol boat captain whose boat was rammed and cut in two by a Japanese destroyer, but who survived. And not only did he survive, all of his crew survived too because of his careful looking after them. On two tiny islands, very close to where I lived and worked for 18 years, they were rescued by local scouts and one of the coast watchers, and then taken back to their American base. The captain was John F. Kennedy, and his story is told in a film and a book called PT-109, which was the number of his patrol boat. I first heard the story from John Kerry, who led the Solomon Island rescue and kept in touch with Kennedy for the rest of Kennedy's life. Without that act of courage, the world may not have had one of the best-known modern leaders. There are acts of courage and kindness to remember, and good things to come out of remembering. In the 1970s there, we had a group of veterans from New Zealand who came and stayed at Goldie College for a week or two, and they wanted to visit places that they had fought in during the Second World War. One of them had been an airman, and he was shot down near an island called Vella La Vella, and he was rescued by Solomon Islanders and cared for by them, and finally rescued and taken out. And when he came, he and his wife went on the long canoe journey, and it was a long canoe journey, to Vella. And he was really absolutely thrilled to meet the people who had rescued him again. The rescuers in that village were equally delighted to see him and astonished to see him, I think. And the end result of that reunion was that several of the veterans group, led by the son of one of them, returned two or three times, and they built some new classrooms for the village school there. They built them as a thank you to those who saved his life, and lasting friendships were made out of that situation. And then thirdly, I think, remembering can encourage forgiveness. And it's very important to be able to forgive. But this must be one of the hardest aspects of remembering, surely. The problem is, of course, that if remembering just increases our hatred or dislike of the people who've hurt us, then it's not going to be a helpful experience. And yet how very hard it must be to really truly forgive those who've hurt us physically and mentally and emotionally. Two instances of more positive remembering stand out in my mind from the 1960s when I was in Birmingham. The first one was at a Youth for Christ meeting in Birmingham Town Hall, and the speaker was the then Bishop of Birmingham. During the war, he had been a prisoner in Singapore in the prisoner of war camp at Changi. And he described the conditions and some of his own personal ill-treatment at the hands of his Japanese captors. And he had been beaten up by the Japanese in that camp. And then he told us how after the war, he had totally unexpectedly, during a service, come face to face with one of the Japanese guards who had beaten him up. And he also explained to us how he was able to speak to the Japanese guard, and they recognized each other, and assure the guard about his forgiveness, as well as God's forgiveness for him. That detailed story was very, very compelling. You could have heard a pin drop amongst all the students and young people in that crowded hall that day. Around about the same time, a group of students went to a nearby Baptist church, and they went to see a film about the bombing and destruction of Hiroshima. And everybody there watched the film, and they were really completely shocked by the extent of the damage and the amount of suffering caused to the people there, suffering that continued well after the war. But what totally shook the people who'd gone to see that film was that at the end of the film, a Japanese student stood up and asked forgiveness of everyone in that church for the way in which the Japanese had behaved during the war. Everyone left that service very impressed and very thoughtful there. And in both instances, of course, the bishop and the Japanese student were people who were clearly following Christ's example. Christ, who, even while he was suffering the physical and mental pain and the humiliation of death on the cross, was able to pray, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." I certainly wondered at that time, and I've wondered many times since, if under similar circumstances, I would honestly be able to forgive. Certainly not in my own strength. By God's grace, maybe. And then fourthly and finally, remembering, I think, reminds us of sacrifice. Often during wartime, it's the sacrifice of young men and of their families who feel their loss most. Young men in two major wars have given up their lives for the freedom that we have and enjoy today. And in John's Gospel, chapter 15 and verse 13, we've been reminded in our second reading of those words of Jesus. The greatest love a person can have for his friends is to give his life for them. And of course, in the next verse, Jesus goes on to say, "You are my friends." As we remember the sacrifice of those who've lost their lives in wartime and those who continue to do it today in places like Afghanistan, we also remember that Jesus was a young man who sacrificed his life for us on the cross. Jesus clearly knew about the crucifixion before it happened. It wasn't just an accident. He warned his disciples several times that this was going to happen. He warned them about his coming death. He also told them that he would give up his life. Nobody would take his life from him. He would give it up. And in the garden before his capture, we know that Jesus asked God, his Father, if possible, to spare him the time of suffering. But at the same time, he agreed, "Not my will, but yours be done." And then further on in the New Testament, in 1 Corinthians, Paul reminds us of Jesus' instruction for all those who follow him, that we should actively and regularly remember Jesus' body broken for us and his blood shed for us on the cross to mark a new covenant between God and his people. And this is what we do, of course, every time we have a communion service. Not only when we have a communion service, but every time when we have a communion service, we remember Jesus' sacrificial death for each one of us. In times of war, in many parts of our world, in the past and still today, people have sacrificed their life to enable us to enjoy the freedom and way of life that we now enjoy. Jesus sacrificed his life on the cross to enable us to enjoy freedom from the consequences and power of sin and death. And by his sacrifice, Jesus opened the way to eternal life. For us, here and now, for those who died in wartime and have gone before us into God's nearer presence already. So let's remember all these sacrifices today.